Good evening. Mitt Romney says he's going to vote Julian Assange one more week in the dock. And we're going to hear about Stephen Cohen, who just passed away, one of the great progressive experts on Russian and American relations. With those stories and more, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for September 22nd, 2020. News outlets are reporting that Judge Amy Coney Barrett has emerged as President Trump's favorite to replace Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Barrett is currently sitting on the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. Trump announced Tuesday morning that he'll announce the pick Saturday at the White House. Reportedly, Trump plans to make his announcement during a primetime address, as he did for Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh earlier in his term. Meanwhile, Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney, who often spars with Trump, said today he plans to vote on the nominee.
And in a circumstance where a nominee of a president is from a different party than the Senate, then more often than not, the Senate does not confirm. So the Garland decision was consistent with that. On the other hand, when there's a nominee of a party that is in the same party as the Senate, then typically they do confirm. So the Garland decision was consistent with that, and the decision to proceed now with the President Trump's nominee is also consistent with history. I came down on the side of the Constitution and precedent as I've studied it, and make the decision on that basis.
Merrick Garland was President Obama's pick, who was refused a Senate hearing in the last, although he was picked 8 months before the end of Obama's term after the death of Antonin Scalia. Romney's decision makes it a near certainty Trump will get his third pick for the United States Supreme Court. And Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers declared a new public health emergency and extended a face covering mandate into November, sparked by a flare-up of coronavirus cases. Tuesday, the United States surpassed the grim milestone of 200,000 COVID-19 deaths. The United States continues to have the world's highest number of COVID-19 deaths on a weekly average. It's losing about 800 lives each day to the virus. The peak was nearly 3,000 deaths a day in mid-April. On Monday, Trump said he had done a phenomenal job on the pandemic that had infected nearly 7 million Americans. But a member of his coronavirus task force, Olivia Troy, says she was shocked by Trump's lack of empathy for victims while steering the task force the White House set up to help in his reelection.
He was really focused on public image, messaging, and it was really more about, you know, his personal agenda than really the agenda that the task force had at hand, which was, how are we going to save and protect Americans?
Troy went on to say Trump thought the positive side of the coronavirus was no longer having to shake hands, a practice he thought was disgusting.
I was sitting to the right of him in the room when he said it, and he was like, and you know, when you're a politician, you have to shake a lot of hands. You have to shake a lot of hands, and these people are disgusting. It's gross. And so maybe COVID's probably a good thing, right? I don't have to shake hands. I don't have to do that anymore.
Former White House Coronavirus Task Force member Olivia Troy. Troy's boss was task force head and vice president Mike Pence, but retired General Keith Kellogg said he was the one who fired her and that her claims are not true.
Olivia Troy worked for me. I fired her. The reason I fired her was her performances started to drop after 6 months working on the task force as a backbencher. She was responsible for coordinating meetings, bringing people together. And when the performance level dropped off, I went to the Vice President of the United States and recommended she leave. I'm the one that escorted her off the compound.
And as former General Keith Kellogg, who sits on the White House Coronavirus Task Force. On Monday, activists organized by the immigrant rights group Mi Gente are kicking off a week of protests ahead of the company Palantir's public direct listing on September 29th. The group wants to end Palantir's contracts with government agencies like ICE and the Department of Homeland Security. Palantir, a data aggregator, has helped ICE target and arrest family members of children crossing the border alone. The company's owner, Peter Thiel, is the founder of PayPal and has been a major contributor to President Donald Trump. Thiel has hosted a dinner for prominent white supremacist Kevin DeAnna, who refers to Trump as his God Emperor. Palantir has also offered to help government agencies resist organizations like WikiLeaks that have leaked troves of government documents. Meanwhile, the extradition hearing for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in London moved to a new stage. A psychiatrist told the court Assange would be a very high suicide risk if he's extradited to the United States for publishing military secrets. Rebecca Miles has been following the hearing and files this report.
The first witness on Tuesday was Professor Michael Kopperman, head of neuropsychiatry at King's College London, who appeared for the defense. Kopperman told the court he'd interviewed Assange in prison on 20 occasions, starting August through December 2019, and had three visits in 2020, taking a full medical history and spoke to friends and family before producing a detailed report presented to the court. He said Assange suffered from severe depression and psychotic symptoms, including auditory hallucinations while in solitary confinement in his cell at the high-security Belmarsh prison. Kopperman said he hallucinated music and voices saying, "You are dust, you are dead, we are coming to get you." The judge asked reporters to exercise some sensitivity about reporting some of the matters heard in court today. Assange's partner, Stella Morris, had said she'd feared Assange would take his life, leaving their two sons, young sons, without a father. During cross-examination, James Lewis suggested to Kopperman that much of his evidence was based on what Assange had told him and was not corroborated by prison medical reports. Instead, it was self-reporting. Kopperman replied that was the nature of psychiatry. It relies on self-reporting. In an extraordinary exchange, Lewis suggested that Assange wasn't in a depressive state because of his outburst in court, which he claimed showed Assange was clearly following the court proceedings, and added that any mental health issues didn't stop Assange from stealing secrets from top levels of government. Kopperman said he was in no position to comment on that. Kopperman concluded his evidence, telling the court if Assange was extradited, he would be placed on SAMs, special administrative measures, kept in solitary confinement and shackled. And asked if Assange was kept under the conditions, it would be very dangerous considering his current mental state. Isolation, he said, experienced in North America would be far worse than anything experienced at the Ecuadorian embassy or Belmarsh prison. Kopperman said Chelsea Manning was held in the Alexandria Detention Center in Virginia and had attempted suicide, and it's where Assange would be held if he's extradited for trial.
And that is Rebecca Miles. She's been covering the Assange extradition hearing at the Old Bailey in London, now in its third week and likely to last for one more week before summations. The judge will then likely take months to make her decision. And stocks finished higher Tuesday as gains in the tech sector offset warnings from Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell that a U.S. recovery from the coronavirus pandemic continues to be highly uncertain. Shares of Amazon climbed nearly 6%. Meanwhile, in testimony before the House Financial Services Committee, Powell said the path forward will depend on keeping the virus under control. The Fed chair was joined by Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, who told the congressional panel the White House has continued to work with Democrats on a long-delayed stimulus. Yesterday's 800-point sell-off came on the heels of a report of files obtained by BuzzFeed and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and released over the weekend concerning leaks of more than 2,000 secret files from the financial investigative agency known as FinCEN. The files, called SARs, for suspicious activity reports, show that billions of dollars in possibly illegal currency transfers happen regularly. The leaked files were responsible for sending stocks tumbling on Monday. Banks have been telling financial reporters that the system, not the banks themselves, are at fault. But Mike German, a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice and a former FBI agent who investigated past scandals, such as the Keating Savings Loan Bank of Commerce and Credit International, BCCI, and Banco Livorno banking scandals in the 1980s, and interconnected with the Iran-Contra scandal that plagued the Reagan White House, says the lack of oversight is a major problem.
Short SAR for suspicious activity report, and it's a reporting mechanism authorized in the Banking Secrecy Act, which allows financial institutions broadly defined to include everything from banks and savings and loans to casinos and post offices and used car dealerships that provide credit, the opportunity to, or the obligation actually, to report to the Treasury Department any transaction they think is suspicious and might be evidence of money laundering. These reports have, previous to the terrorist attacks of 9/11, there were tens of thousands of these reports being filed. Afterwards, under an expanded provision in the Patriot Act, they increased to quickly to 1 million, and now over 2 million a year being submitted, partly because the Treasury Department doesn't give the financial institutions any advice on what constitutes a suspicious transaction. And there are serious penalties for not reporting, what they call defensive reporting. And the financial institutions tend to file a lot of these reports to the Treasury Department.
They're not public documents?
No, they're certainly not public documents. They contain an awful lot of private financial information. Most people, and certainly privacy advocates, would be very concerned about their public release. They are very widely shared within the law enforcement community, though. That raises the concerns of privacy and civil liberties advocates like me, that there is an awful lot of information that most people consider private when they engage in some kind of financial transaction. So for this to, without good reason, be designated as suspicious and passed around as a suspicious activity report to multiple law enforcement agencies is highly problematic, the way many other mass surveillance programs are problematic.
But these FinCEN files, here's something different.
The problem has been that this type of surveillance has increased exponentially since 9/11, and we have virtually no accountability for how law enforcement uses it. And like many mass surveillance programs, they're sort of sold as a preventative measure. The agencies will say, well, if we have access to this information, we can prevent this bad conduct, in this case, money laundering, from occurring. But that's not what happens. The information just is stockpiled for whenever a reason someone in law enforcement wants to target somebody, whether there's a legitimate reason or not. And in fact, what these documents that were leaked now show is that there was plenty of money laundering that now not just financial institutions were aware of, but that law enforcement was aware of and didn't do anything to stop, or didn't do enough to stop.
Usually somebody goes to jail for money laundering, it's based on somebody being arrested for drugs and then snitching on their friend, part of doing business. What you're talking about here is something very different.
And I think that's probably still true if you look at actual money laundering prosecutions, that they're sort of add-on charges. When you use the proceeds of that criminal activity to enrich yourself, that creates another criminal violation. What we know from these leaks and from previous leaks, it's really investigative journalists who have done this work more aggressively than the government, is that there is large-scale money laundering being done, often with cooperation of some officials within financial institutions, if not the financial institution itself. And there doesn't seem to be an aggressive government effort to target that kind of high-level elite fraud and money laundering that's going on.
Billions of dollars are going into the pockets of Russian oligarchs and who knows who.
Exactly. And when you look at a case like the Manafort prosecution, all of the fraud and other charges against Manafort were for conduct long before he had been named as the campaign manager for the Trump administration. So those crimes could have been prosecuted years ago and it never would have become an issue. This methodology is not very effective in preventing money laundering and doesn't seem to be a deterrent to either the money launderers themselves or the financial institutions. As one of the articles suggested, it's kind of a get out of jail free card, because by reporting the suspicious activity to the government, the financial institution itself can continue engaging with those customers if ever criticized for it or charged for it, can say, hey, we let the government know about this and they didn't take action, so we assumed it was fine.
Reminds me in a weird way of J. Edgar Hoover. I mean, are police agencies voyeurs who just sit around and laugh about things that are going on and don't do anything about it because the people are too powerful?
Yeah, it's a lot of it. I think there's a lot of blame, right? That if you look at the white collar crime laws that are passed, they're often very complex and have high degrees of proof that are required, often in convoluted ways. So it makes it difficult for law enforcement officers to be able to bring a provable case to a prosecutor that they would want to bring into a courtroom. What we found out is that there is a lot of information that the government has that it could use to better effect if there was a greater transparency in how they handle these types of reports. We can dig deeper to get an explanation from not just the Treasury Department, but the FBI and the Justice Department about why these prosecutions aren't being pursued against these very high-level actors.
Mike German is a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice and a former FBI agent who investigated past banking scandals such as the Keating Savings and Loan, BCCI, and Banco Livorno. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Stephen F. Cohen, an eminent historian whose books and commentaries on Russia examine the rise and fall of communism, Kremlin dictatorships, and the emergence of a post-Soviet nation still struggling for identity in the 21st century, died on Friday at his home in Manhattan. He was 81. His wife, Katrina Vandenhoevel, the publisher and part owner of The Nation, said the cause was lung cancer. The executive editor of the American Committee for East-West Accord, where Cohen was a board member, is James Carden. He's also a contributing writer with The Nation. He says Cohen was an unforgettable contributor to understanding Russia.
Was considered by many in his field and outside of his field to be the preeminent historian of Russia. His books have had an outsized influence on not only his field, but on the course of Soviet history, particularly with regard to his biography of Nikolai Bukharin. He was someone who had a big imprint outside of the academy as well. He was one of the premier public intellectuals during the 1980s over the debates about Russia policy, about detente. He would frequently debate the other more conservative eminent historian of Russia, Richard Pipes. Steve was a consultant and frequent presence on CBS News during the end of the Cold War. He attracted a lot of controversy in recent years over his views with regard to the crisis in Ukraine and then later what became known as Russiagate. Steve wore a lot of hats.
He was an outsider.
The dominant narrative of U.S.-Russian relations, he usually challenged. There was no challenge big enough. He was always tilting at windmills.
Did he know Putin? Did he ever meet Putin, talk to him personally?
No.
Oliver Stone did. What does Oliver Stone know about Russia? How come this guy didn't talk to him?
I know that Oliver consulted with Steve. I met Oliver once briefly, and I said to him, I think we have a couple of acquaintances in common. He said, who? And I said, Stephen and Katrina. Katrina Vandenhoevel, Stephen's wife. Oliver looked at me, took a minute, and I thought that there was going to be some real piece of wisdom coming at me. And Oliver gathered his thoughts, and he said, you know what? I wish I was as good on TV as Steve is.
What did Stephen think about what's happened? The Hunter Biden's going to be dragged up in front of some committee or not in regards to this, to go after the Bidens. What would he have said about all of this?
I'm not sure about what he would have thought about that particular issue. My sense is that, in a way, the Republicans are obviously handling it in a very ham-handed and opportunistic fashion. If you move the frame out from Hunter, there are legitimate questions about how our elites comport themselves when they're in office. I get the sense that if something like the vice president's son being put on a board, being paid vast amounts of money for expertise which he does not possess, If that happened in another country, you know, we'd be holding congressional hearings and calling that country, you know, backwards. And, well, what can we do to fix that? It was kind of the feeling I got when we had the wife of a former president running for president. And we have now all these sorts of dynasties and people talk about, well, Michelle Obama should run or Chelsea should get into politics, too. Sort of strikes me as kind of the way banana republics run, not the way the United States should run. So obviously the Republicans are out for blood regarding Hunter, but I think there's a bigger story there that we need to look at. But unfortunately, we don't have people in the Congress who can for a moment put aside their partisan instincts and do something for the public good.
Following up on the BuzzFeed release of the FinCEN files, which show these SARs, these suspicious activity reports or SARs that the government uses to track down money laundering, that show Russian oligarchs are sort of like featured at the top throughout all of this. And are the Russian government that corrupt?
Yeah, probably. I often get tarred with the same brush that Steve used to as being pro-Russian and all that stuff. I'm certainly not. I think that, so that doesn't surprise me in the least. They have very, very severe problems with regard to corruption. The question, I think, is what is it that we can and should do about it? I would say that we need to take a closer look at our own kind of oligarchic tendencies here at home. I would suggest that there are multilateral ways to deal with issues of transnational corruption without slipping into a kind of new Cold War frenzy. And I think that that would be an argument that Steve might agree with as well.
James Carden is executive editor of the American Committee for East-West Accord. And in New York City, progressive groups, New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson and several city council members called for passage of legislation that would require large buildings to make significant emergency efficiency upgrades and dramatically reduce climate pollution. They say buildings are the source of 70% of New York City's climate pollution. The bill, known as Intro 1947, would amend a previous law, Local Law 97, that requires landlords to retrofit their buildings to better meet goals of a 20% reduction of emissions by 2030. Intro 1947 would include many rent-regulated buildings in a requirement for emissions reduction. Because of the passage of rent reforms earlier this year, that means tenants won't be forced to pay for the modifications. Here are excerpts from today's City Council hearing.
The most high-polluting buildings that are taken in 2024, and that means that they're probably the most inefficient. And so they have the easiest, lowest cost opportunities to actually save themselves money and cut their emissions at the same time. So for a lot of these buildings, they're going to be actually able to save money net, especially with all the financing up front, paying their cash costs. So, you know, this is a big opportunity for the city. Obviously, there's many, many different types of buildings across the city, but your typical owner is going to be able to comply with this law and save money out of it.
I am the energy committee head of the 60 Cooper Street Co-op and also a member of WE Act. We have rent-controlled tenants in our building, but we do not get the exemption because we're a co-op. We've spent over $100,000 to comply with Local Law 97, and we're in full support of Local Law 97. And I am very much in support of Introduction 1947. But I think it's extremely unfair that co-ops are having to pull 100% of our weight in Local Law 97 and that big landlords and developers do not. And they don't live here. We do. We breathe the air here. And they don't. They get the exemptions. They're saving millions of dollars. And it's on our backs.
Hi, my name is Christopher Athenaeus. I'm a small property owner of two buildings, which are over 25,000 square feet. And I'd like to voice my objection to Intro 1947. I'd like you to understand what my family has done to make these buildings more energy efficient over the last 40 years that we've owned these properties. We've changed windows, roofs, boilers, burners. We've installed solar panels on the roofs. With the recent passage of HSTPA of 2019, all of our long-term plans to renovate apartments, which included these type of energy plans, such as insulating an apartment, came to a grinding halt since we're only permitted to get a rent increase on $15,000 of improvements every 15 years. This negligible amount cannot nearly cover such the cost of such energy improvements. We're even challenged with apartments that are not subject to rent regulation because in the outer boroughs, such as where I am in Brooklyn, we can't simply keep raising the rents.
My name is Margot Perkins, and I'm a member of 350 NYC, and we've been very involved for the passage of the Local Law 97 and now hopefully 1947. There will only be a rapid and just recovery in this city if we generate good-paying jobs now, and Local Law 97 has the potential to do that. Urban Green Council estimates that we will require 140,000 jobs by 2030, and these will be good-paying jobs that will stimulate the economy.
My name is Joseph Cherup, and I am the Director of Horticulture at Greenwood Cemetery. We are a National Historic Landmark and a 478-acre green space in the heart of Brooklyn and the heart of Councilmember Menchaca's district. Determining the cause of the extreme weather events that are ravaging this country and the world on a near-weekly basis is not rocket science. They are caused by extreme heat, the result of climate change. As greenhouse gas emissions are the most significant driver of climate change, I applaud the commitment of this bill to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in New York City. We at Greenwood are also at Greenwood. We are developing new strategies to manage the turf in urban green spaces that effectively and sustainably address short and long-term needs for a changing climate. If the strategies that we are developing at Greenwood are adopted citywide, which is our hope, they will have a measurable impact on the resilience of our urban environment.
Annie Gorneva.
While there are already many trained and in-training low- and moderate-income workers in New York City that will be able to take advantage of the jobs created by this bill, especially in construction, the creative and management roles in design and renovation are still lacking in terms of diversity and accessibility. The city must put its money where its mouth is and provide deep investments in education and training programs in design, renovation, and construction so that our communities can turn their talents into the skills and credentials necessary to access energy efficient careers. Without this step, the jobs created will go to those that already have a leg up on economic opportunity and will continue to drive the gentrification and displacement we've seen over the last two decades. This is why we desperately need holistic solutions like this introduction, as well as the Green New Deal, that tackle the root systemic fault lines in our society.
Those were excerpts from today's City Council hearing into the bill, Intro 1947, a law meant to require modifications meant to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from residential buildings in New York City. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, September 22nd, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry and Rebecca Miles. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.